Hi, good Vach. As you celebrate it, happy Thanksgiving, and we are now up to Parshat Toldot. This is Yisachar Wartel. So, towards the beginning of this week's Parsha, hopefully I haven't said this to our before, but if I did, it's a good one. It's also going to be in my upcoming Sefer Parsha Ponderings, Volume 1, Bezrat Hashem. It's in the process of being published. So if you're interested, please contact Jake or Ellie at Sheer Enjoyment to get more information about my other Divrei Torah, my Sefers, or just in general, about other Sheer Enjoyment speakers and other works that they may have out there. So anyway, let's begin. Towards the beginning of this week's Parsha, Rivka has trouble conceiving and then has a problem with her pregnancy. She goes to seek advice and finds out that there are two intrinsically different individuals who will become warring and inversely related nations. Not like typical twins, right? They're pretty different from each other. So the Pasuk states, Mema'echa yiparedu, from their womb they will separate, which is kind of an astounding concept. Seemingly, this means that they are already separate or distinct in Rivka's womb, or that they will immediately separate upon birth. However, no man or woman is intrinsically born evil. Some have evil tendencies, and I spoke about that in this week's Torah. You know, my written Torah did it. Sorry, getting carried away. A little distracted tonight. I apologize. So, some people may have evil tendencies, but they can always overcome them. One of the best examples is Amalek, a descendant of Esau. The nation of Amalek has to be eradicated at all costs, and there are no exceptions. However, if an Amalekite decides to convert to Judaism, he is welcome in the congregation. How is that possible? We have to outright destroy them. So how can an Amalekite become a Jew? Because he's only an Amalekite when he acts like an Amalekite. In fact, it's a big question who we treat as an Amalekite. Certainly, you know, a couple thousand years ago, whether or not they actually had to have the lineage or they just took on the practices or the ideas of an Amalekite. But anyway, a person who was an Amalekite but gets rid of that inherent falsehood or whatever problems there were, he overcomes this inherent nature and he chooses to do good and become part of the Jewish people and throws off this label of doubt and happenstance and anti-religiousness, whatever it might be. He is now not only free from the decree of death, but is praiseworthy. So too Esau. He could have done this, right? He could have overcome this tendency to do evil and to all his taivas to do, you know, murder and everything else that he's done wrong. But he chose to embrace it. He chose to let it affect who he was. Now, he was on many levels a very wicked person, but he was not ultimately destined to be his way. He ultimately chose his destiny. He may have had that proclivity, but he ultimately chose who he was. And therefore, one can read the pasuk as the me'echa yifaredu, as they will separate on their own accord, long after they will leave the womb. Now, after a lengthy interlude pertaining to Yitzhak's travails with Abimelech and the people of Gerar, we are reintroduced to Yaakov and to Esau. They were last mentioned when Yaakov tricked Esau into giving up his birthright, and we now enter the scene where, as Yaakov becomes blind and his life is seemingly coming to a close, even though it's not really, he wants to give his sons a final blessing. He still perceives Esau as a firstborn and probably more misguided than truly wicked, still holding out hope for him. Esau is told to therefore prepare meat and delicacies for his father, and while he is out doing so, Rivka is very aware of what's happening, knows that Esau is truly evil, knows what's going on, also has a prophecy of what's supposed to happen. She knows what all of this means and therefore what has to be done, which is not an easy decision. She knows the prophecy that the older will serve the younger, and presumably she knows what happened with the sale of the birthright on some level. And therefore, when Rivka divulges her plan to Yaakov, it says, "V'Rivka amra el Yaakov bina," and Yaakov said to Rivka, her son. Why does the Torah need to say bina, her son? Do we not know who Yaakov is? Rather, Yaakov was her son, much as the way that Esav was Yitzchak's son. There's a lot of different midrashim and mefarshim explaining how Esav used to appease his father and bring him delicacies and ask him nice questions and things like that with kibbutz. So Rivka and Yaakov shared a special bond of closeness and clearly knew what she was doing was right. And in order to put her son in such danger, she knew it was Min HaShemayim. She knew it had to be that way. Now, when Rivka is getting Esau's clothes to fit onto Yaakov, the pasuk describes Esau as Bena HaGadol, her son, the big one, and Yaakov as Bena HaKatan, her son, the small one. This seemingly corresponds to the sheer contrast of Esau's large, bulky body to that of Yaakov's smaller, you know, simpler body. However, the meaning goes far deeper than that. It was specifically the clothing, the exterior, that was great for Esau and small for Yaakov. But internally, it was just the opposite. Esav was primarily his clothes, his weapons, his body, much like the Greeks and the Romans were. This is hinted to in Breishi Rabbah, where it's cited by Rashi, the fat of the land that Esav was promised was ultimately the Italy and Greece. It was the rich Mediterranean area originally inhabited by Alexander the Great and later the Roman Empire, also known as Edom, a synonym for Esav. And unlike Esav, who had little quarter with being, Yaakov took little notice of his actual body, and in general took little notice of the physical, but dwelled in Torah and proper actions as an innocent individual, a tam, right, as we call him. Yet now Yaakov was faced with a real test. He was asked to cover up his purity and put on the symbolic clothes of Esav, which is something which is very much against his nature. When he seemingly does a convincing job, you know, with the help of heaven, as Yitzhak, upon examining him, declares, "V'hayidayim yidei Esav, ha'kol kol Yaakov." These are the hands of Esav, and the voice of Yaakov. Yitzhak is bewildered by the conflicts of these seemingly opposite attributes. Doesn't seem like it makes sense on many levels, not getting into it further. But it's this Yad, this Yudalid, that makes all the difference. The difference in numerical value between these two phrases, V'hayidayim yidei Esav, and ha'kol kol Yaakov, is actually 14, or Yad. The Yad is what really makes a difference. It's seemingly a very physical object. It manipulates things, it works the ground, it handles things, including weapons. Yet, the concept of Yad, which also is connected to the concept of Hey, with the Hey is made up of the letters Yud and Dalet, is incredibly, incredibly important in Kabbalah. The aspect of the hand, which we also see by the concept of the Chamsa and the five fingers and what they represent, the hand is probably the most spiritually connected part of a person's body. And, you know, you could argue the heart, the head, whatever, but the hand has so much together, right? The Yud and the Dalet represent a simple combination between the spiritual world and the physical world. There's so much more to get into on this, not getting into right now. But combining the aspects of a spiritual voice with that of a hand, which is physical, is not problematic. So that didn't bother Yitzchak. What Yitzchak could not comprehend, however, was that a kol, a voice, which is so pure and barely physical, can be combined with Yudei Esav. Esau's hands. These were not hands that brought in spiritual light, that is Esau's hands. These were hands that pushed it away. And he knew that Esau was struggling with material things and trials and tribulations and physical tests. And the voice, it didn't seem to resonate with that. The voice was something much more pure, and it didn't seem to jive together. So therefore, it really, really was an ace that was Min HaShemayim, because otherwise Yitzchak would, I mean, if it was completely without the hand of heaven, Yitzchak would have clearly realized that Yaakov was trying something, which is something he would have never suspected of Yaakov, but he would have ultimately stopped and say, wait a second, there's something clearly wrong here. I need to know what's going on. I'm not giving you the blessing to explain to me what's going on, right? Especially as a man of din. So obviously it was Min HaShemayim that things worked out the way they did, but it's not surprising why he was confused. But Yitzchak says, Hem Yadav Ki Yidei Esav Echav Se'arot. These are the hands of the hairy brother, the physical one. Why would he have phrased this blessing request as we did? Because he used his hands in a physical matter only. He didn't use them to give tzedakah or to help, you know, somebody with their bags or, you know, drive somebody somewhere, right? Whatever it was, like, he didn't use his hands, he didn't use his limbs to help people. He used them to grab what he wanted. We have to learn to use our hands for mitzvah, to put the yud, the spirituality, before the dalet, and give an open hand rather than put the Dalet before the Yud. Because if you put the Dalet before the Yud, that forms the word Dai, which means enough, right? It's like, you keep taking the hand because you keep taking more with that hand because you can never have more than enough. You want to keep getting it. But with respect to other people, you have enough, right? What I have is enough. Yeah, I can't spare it. And then you have a closed and stingy hand. No, you want to lead with the Yud. You want to be open-handed. You want to be generous and help other people. For that truly is the difference between good and evil. Ultimately, the evil people are not only selfish, but they don't want to help people because they're worried about how that may affect themselves. And a righteous person is so much more concerned about other people than about his own personal needs and certainly personal wants. Obviously, it's not saying that we can't have nice things. Nobody's saying that. But the focus is on what's important and what Hashem wants and what's spiritual and what is good. And ultimately, almost everybody falls somewhere in between. It's very rare that you have somebody who's very, very wicked, very, very righteous, but there are those people. And some of the quintessential examples are Yaakov and Esau, as we see in this week's Parsha. Shabbat Shalom.